in entering this book again today, I'd like to begin with a prayer and a prayer for what I call the prophetic imagination or the prophetic vision. That's really for eyes to see what God is about in the world. Let's pray. As you gave Isaiah of old vision, give us, O God, vision to see what you are doing in our world today. Amen. Related to the prayer I just prayed, I was thinking about the forum last night. I think many of you were at the forum. And if we were going to focus on what we mean by prophetic, in the Old Testament, the word prophetic means, first of all, speaking forth the word of God in a present situation. And it's secondary as predicting of the future, and often we use the word prophecy as primarily predicting the future. But it was a word of God spoken in the context, and it really was a word of vision of how God is working in history. The forum last night, if it were going to be a forum in the tradition of the prophets, the title would be a discussion on how is God working in the world today, considering the United States and the Soviet Union. Then we would have a requirement in the forum that you could not express any opinion unless you would, in front you would say, I think God is doing this in the world. And I would ask, would this change our discussion?
Yes. Yes.
Now, I think there was some of that behind it, because we are people of faith and we struggle, but that would make it very conscious, you know, to not that we would have the answers, but it would be a sharing of our struggles to see, to have that kind of a vision. And the danger of it is to make decisions that the way I see it is the way God is working in the world. Is that ever done? On the board here, I tried to put some of these thoughts about themes of the Isaiah school that we're going to follow now. And I still don't have them in a neat outline, but the first two, the theme of preaching against idolatry and preaching against injustice to the poor, and how both of those are considered, remember, wrong mangers, false feed boxes. Going for food where there is no food, and then also the image of leaving the true lover. Yahweh is your true lover, and practicing idolatry and injustice to the poor is going off to other lovers, either other gods or the false god of materialism or wealth or consumption. Three, a theme, the external religion is futile. God is not going to protect you if you go through the right, correct rituals or ritual religious actions. Then four, and I have all of these under four, and this is a major theme of the Old Testament prophets, including Isaiah and the school of Isaiah, that God is the God of history. And specifically in Isaiah, that means that because of your sinfulness, because of your idolatry, your injustice, destruction and punishment will come. But then the hope that goes through the book and the school of Isaiah, a remnant will survive. And then from that remnant, God will bring forth a glorious new day led by a Davidic king. And do you know what I mean by Davidic king? It would be a king in the line of David, who will be the one who will bring a world of peace, or as in Isaiah 2, the dream of Isaiah, a whole world where the nations beat their swords into plowshares and they learn more, no more. There's peace on earth under the gentle, just rule of a Davidic king. That's the dream. Now, I redrew the map on the board, and these little dots here. I've always been curious where countries today are in relation to the ancient world. So I have Saudi Arabia here, I have Jordan, I have Iraq, I have Syria, I have Iran over here. And I just did that for my own curiosity. Today we are going to look, oh, I gotta pull my chart now. So if you want a copy, if this week you would choose to read the whole book of Isaiah, this may be helpful to just figure out what chapters and where they're from. And this is some of the best guessing of scholars. Because remember, the book of Isaiah isn't all the words of Isaiah, but in a way it's the school textbook. So the later school of Isaiah, much later the disciples of Isaiah, put together many writings, including the writings of Isaiah, including the writings of the great preacher of the exile that we'll look at tomorrow, including preachers of after the exile or Babylonian captivity. There's many, many writings, and this is an attempt to kind of figure out where different chapters came from. So if you want to just pull the chart up and jot that down, it helps a little in the reading of the book.
Dan, question. You talk about the school of Isaiah and the later writings of the school. Could there be a parallel between that and the New Testament school of Jesus followers? Would that be a similar approach?
And then within Jesus' followers, you'd have disciples of Paul. So you'd have a Pauline school. You'd have a Peter school. You'd have a John school.
Was that similar then to Isaiah's school?
And in a way, I have this, my own theory that Luke and the writings of Luke and Luke Acts maybe are the most intentional restoration of the Isaiah school. Not the only, but maybe the most intentional. And we'll look at that on Friday. If we're on schedule, we're going to look at the New Testament and ask the question, is the Isaiah school of theology revived and renewed in the New Testament? Today I want to look at how the Isaiah school was really formed by two great crisis periods in the history of Judah, which, remember, is a southern kingdom. When Solomon's kingdom was divided, Israel here is to the north, Judah here is to the south. Israel, the capital of Samaria, Judah, the capital of Jerusalem. The kings of Judah are in the Davidic line, are all descendants of King David. And then Israel, the king, is whoever wins the current assassination plot. And so a real difference of stability in the, you can see if you follow Israel, one king reigned in 745 and then another later in 745. And another later in 745, reigned until 738. And then the next king reigned 2 years until he was killed by the next one, 737, who reigned 5 years. So that was the stability of the northern kingdom, or instability of the northern kingdom. But the southern, it's the Davidic line. Now, two great crises. Now, first, Uzziah died, and then Jotham, his son, followed him. And then 735, Jotham dies, and Ahaz, the son of Jotham, succeeds him. And Ahaz, unfortunately, sometimes this happens in history, a time of great crisis when a nation needs strong, decisive leadership, they get an Ahaz, who just was not a strong, astute king of Israel, and we're going to see that. The crisis that comes now, and this crisis brings Isaiah out into public, brings him out to preach directly to the king, and that's in chapter 7 of Isaiah. And I'll read this, and while I'm reading it, I will... I'll stop once in a while and make a comment. In the reign of Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezon, the king of Aram. Now, Aram is Syria. Okay, think of that, and it's where Assyria, it's It's where Syria is today, and the capital then was Damascus, which is the capital of Syria today. So this is kind of a neat, same country, same capital. King of Syria, or Aram, went up against Jerusalem with Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, to lay siege to it, but he was unable to capture it. Now, the situation here is, remember that Tiglath-Pileser III reviving or establishing now the Assyrian Empire has gone north. Now, you never go from Assyria west over this. Why? John, I think, and Carol could explain. There must be a desert. Desert. So you go up and around. And now Tiglath-Pileser has already conquered the north part of Syria. So Israel and Aram, or Syria, at that time said, I know how we'll stop Tiglath-Pileser III. Two nations can't do it, but three little nations together can form enough power to stop Tiglath-Pileser III. Now we need one more nation. Which one shall we pick?
Judah.
We'll get Judah. You get on the telephone. This is a joke. Get on the telephone. You call Ahaz and say, we'd like you to join our alliance. Ahaz says, no, so okay then, we will invade you, take you over, throw you out, put up a puppet king in Jerusalem that will join our alliance against Tiglath-Pileser. And that's the way it goes. And now these two nations are invading Judah in an attempt to defeat Judah, to establish a puppet king, bring them into the Israel-Syria alliance against Assyria. Is everybody following this? The news was brought to the house of David. Aram, they said, or Syria, has reached Ephraim. Ephraim is Israel. You have to realize, you know, there's different names. Then the heart of the king and the hearts of the people shuddered as the trees of the forest shuddered in the front of the wind. Have you seen the aspens in Colorado? Where there's 14 aspens up the road here. Shuddering of the leaves, that's the way the people were as these two little nations. And Yahweh said to Isaiah, go with your son Shear-Jashub. How many of you have named children there? Shear-Jashub. This shows how Isaiah's message was his whole life. For when his wife, who was a prophetess, now they were both preachers, gave birth to their first son here, they named him Shear-Jashub, which means a remnant shall return. A remnant shall return. Okay, they met Ahaz at the end of the conduit of the upper pool. Now, what was Ahaz doing there? He was doing a thing called worry, 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 worry. Because Hezekiah's tunnel had not been built yet, so the Jerusalem water supply was vulnerable. It came from outside of the city into the city, and an army laying siege could quickly find the water supply and cut off the water supply. So he's just not being by the water there, as you know, this is a nice place to stand, but it's worry, worry, worry. And then Isaiah comes up to says, you know, hi, Ahaz, and I'd like you to meet my son. A remnant shall return. And this is what Isaiah says to him, and it's on Fuller's Field Road. Can't you see the little street sign? Fuller's Field Road. Pay attention, Ahaz. Keep calm. Have no fear. Do not let your heart sink because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands. Smoldering stumps of firebrands. The picture is a tree burning down. And it burns and burns and burns, and just before it's through burning, there's just a few little smoldering ashes inside of it. And you are quaking and shivering in fear, or shaking in fear, because of two smoldering stumps, these two little nations, or because Aram, Ephraim, the son of Remaliah, have plotted to ruin you, and I've said, let us invade Judah and terrorize it and seize it for ourselves to set up a king there, the son of Tabil. Oh, that's a joke. The son of Tabil means good for nothing. These two smoldering stumps want to set up Mr. Good for Nothing to be king of this land. The Lord Yahweh says, it shall not come true. Now, why is Isaiah's message here so important? It's because Ahaz has made a stupid, in the opinion of Isaiah and God. Do you believe Isaiah speaks the word of God? A stupid political decision. This nation of Judah has decided to go to Assyria and ask Assyria to protect us against Israel and Syria, or Aram. Now what happens when a teeny little country asks a great big expanding empire country, will you protect us? What happens to a little country? And Isaiah knew that. And Ahaz thought he had a smart idea. He would get on the side of Assyria. And Isaiah just says, no. Sell the country out. And the reason for the no is there's no reason to do it. Because, you know, if you wait this one out, then Assyria is going to attack Syria. Am I getting the in the front? So you're both. Assyria will attack Syria and Israel and will just devastate them, these two smoldering stumps. So just wait it out. Now, some people say Isaiah was kind of unrealistic, you know, just trust in the Lord and everything will be okay. Astute in his politics. Wait it out. This is the word of the Lord. And then, as was announced to Isaiah in his call in Isaiah 6, would Ahaz listen? No. Even if now Isaiah says it shall not come true, verse 8, 6 or 5 years more and a shattered Ephraim shall no longer be a people. But if you do not stand by me, you will not stand at all. Isaiah, if we knew Hebrew, uses all kinds of cute word plays. And I mean cute in the best sense. Like this, if you do not stand by me, you will not stand at all. The end of the two phrases, one is tha aminu, and then the aminu. Two words that sound almost like alike, so it would get a listener to listen like that. You know, it's a poetic way of writing. Now Isaiah isn't going to give up. Once again, Yahweh spoke to Ahaz and said, ask Yahweh your God for a sign for yourself coming either from the depths of Sheol or from the heights above. This word comes to Ahaz, ask for a sign from God, and then Ahaz plays pious. No, because he doesn't want to hear the word of God because he's already made up his own mind. Has that ever happened to us? Don't tell me the word of the Lord. No, my mind is made up. So we come by this, then he comes with this pious thing, I will not put Yahweh to the test. And then Isaiah says, whether you want it or not, I am going to give you a sign. A sign to the prophets, it's something you look at, and by seeing it visually, you get it, what's happening in history. And here's the sign. Listen now, house of David. Are you not satisfied with trying the patience of humans without trying the patience of my God too? The Lord, Yahweh, will give you a sign, and it is this. And would someone read this in the RSV because it's more familiar words. 14 and 15 of Isaiah 7. No, is that
here? There.
Oh. Go ahead. read it loudly.
Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a young woman shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good.
And read the next verse too.
For before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land before whose two kings you are in dread will be deserted.
Now, what's interesting, is this a familiar verse? Mm-hmm. Yeah. A young woman shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel, God with us. You know, and we are accustomed as Christians to only seeing this verse as it was later interpreted in the New Testament. And now to look at the verse in its context in Isaiah. And Isaiah is saying to Ahaz, now here's the sign. Someone in your court, and we don't know who it was, it might have been the wife of Ahaz, the child might have been the next king, Hezekiah, who was a relief after Ahaz. But someone was pregnant. And Isaiah just pointed to her, says, behold, a young woman shall conceive. Or I guess if literally it hadn't happened yet. Shall conceive, and then will bear a son. And this son will be the sign that God is with us. And before this child grows up to discern the difference between good and evil, the two smoldering stumps will be devastated. And it happened. The woman in the court gave birth. Maybe it was Ahaz's wife. This was quite a thing to bear, to look at this child and say, this, the prophet of God said, is the sign. But did Ahaz listen? No. So Ahaz did the dumb thing, took a trip to Assyria to set up an alliance. Thought he was a big deal walking into the Assyrian court, and he probably got the 3:47 appointment in the afternoon with Tiglath-Pileser III. And Tiglath-Pileser III is more than happy to make a deal. And all that Ahaz has to give is tribute money, which almost breaks the money financial situation of Judah. The taxes go up to pay the tribute. Pay. And then the Assyrians have another, just one more thing we'd like you to do, Ahaz. Here's the plans of the Assyrian temple. We'd like you to go back to Jerusalem and completely rebuild the inside of Solomon's temple in Jerusalem to make it look like the Assyrian temple, which we can't even begin to understand the symbolic nature of what that meant in those religious societies. Yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. Ahaz goes back, raises the taxes to pay the tribute, and then rebuilds the inside of the Jerusalem temple to make it look like the Assyrian temple. Now, close that would be to worshiping the Assyrian gods. And then Assyria does invade, wipes out Syria, breaks it up into Assyrian provinces, attacks Judah, takes most of the land of Israel, and only leaves a small amount of land around Assyria that remains then for a while. Now the kingdom of Israel and the two smoldering stumps are wiped out. It's all over. Isaiah was right, and Judah is left with the heavy tribute money and a redesigned temple. Now what does Isaiah do? Takes his disciples, this is the guess, because now he's silent for many years. Let's go to school. Now it's school time. They're quiet. They're thinking, they're studying, they're discerning the will of God. And I would bet that every day they're reading every newspaper. By newspaper, I mean they're listening to everything that is happening in the events of the world. And they're waiting for another crisis time, because the crisis time is the time for the preacher to speak So now we move to the next great crisis. The next Assyrian ruler, Shalmaneser V, and then after him is Sargon II, and he reigned 722 to 705. Now, he is involved in the campaigns in the north and the east. So during the reign of Sargon, it's relatively quiet in Judah, except for the tribute money and the continuation of the redesigned temple in Judah. But because Assyria is now busy this way and this way, when Hezekiah comes to power in 715, then he is able to begin reforms. First thing he does is, or one of the first things, he strips out the Assyrian redesigning of the temple and renews the temple and also renews Yahweh worship takes out idol worship and the worship of Assyrian gods and other gods and restores Yahweh worship. You see, Hezekiah, who some would say in that context was a son that was born as Emmanuel in the court of Ahaz, we don't know. But Hezekiah, this reform, not only a religious reform, but it's a nationalistic reform. Look what Hezekiah is doing. He's getting rid of that Assyrian temple. Again, we'll stand on our own two feet and be our own nation, which works for a while because Assyria is busy elsewhere. Then Assyria begins to threaten this. Remember what I said is kind of the vroom, vroom, vroom? Is that the word I used or what? What? Now the next, according to Isaiah, the next stupid thing is about ready to happen. Hezekiah should know better because he's a stronger, more decisive king than Ahaz was. And what Hezekiah has decided to do is that now there's a renewal of Egypt. The Ethiopians have come up from the south, taken over Egypt, and established a strong new Egypt called sometimes the Ethiopian dynasty. And they knew the biggest threat to their power to control towards the north is Assyria coming down from the south. So now one thing Egypt decides to do, why don't we get the nations that are still relatively free from Assyria to be on our side and form an alliance with us, and then together the armies of Egypt and the Philistines, see this little crack here, coastal plain, that's where the Philistines are. So Egypt says, we'll get the Philistines and Judah to be on our side in an alliance against Assyria. And so Egypt and Hezekiah get together, and Hezekiah packs up his attaché case and is on his way down to Egypt to form an alliance with Egypt. And Isaiah, no, comes out hiding. And now let's turn to chapter 30. In 711, there had been an Egypt-inspired revolt against paying tribute to Assyria, and Hezekiah didn't join at this time, maybe partly because of the teaching of Isaiah. What Isaiah did in the 711 revolt, this gives you an idea he was not kind of a three-piece suit type of prophet. You know, sometimes we think he was because he had easy access to the kings. But in the 711 revolt, as a sign to discourage Judah from being involved, he walked around the streets of the city of Jerusalem in the nude. And then that's in, if you want to follow that, it's in chapter 20. One of the shortest chapters in the Bible is called Isaiah in the Nude. I won't read it now, but it was a way of a sign. This is what is going to happen to the nations who ally themselves with Egypt against Assyria. They're going to be stripped. Look at me as the sign. Everything, in a way, to Isaiah was a sign. Look at me as a sign of what will happen to you. So they do avoid the 711 rebellion, but then comes the 705, and this is a wonderful time to rebel against Assyria and join the alliance, because Sargon the second dies in 705, and now Sennacherib is new, and when a ruler is new, he's consolidating his power. And that's a wonderful time. It's a time of vulnerability. So now Egypt says to Judah, this is the time for us to get together against Assyria. And Hezekiah thinks this is a good deal to Egypt. Hezekiah is being used as a buffer. Can you see? Egypt, Judah, buffer. And Assyria has already basically taken over Philistines. So now the 705, when there's a change in administration in Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, this is the time now when the Egyptians convince Hezekiah to join the rebellion and to ally themselves with Egypt. Chapter 30, woe to those rebellious sons. Remember, that's how Isaiah started? The wandering to other mangers. And now the false feed box, the false place of food and security and health is Egypt. They carry out plans that are not mine. They make alliances not inspired by me, and so add sin to sin. They have packed up their cases and I'm adding now. All their business papers, attaché cases, representatives, and they've all gone down there to Egypt without even consulting me, Yahweh. They didn't even ask me to take refuge in Pharaoh's protection. This is a hurt lover. You get it? To shelter in Egypt's shadow. Remember the confession of Israel and Judah was under the shadow of Yahweh's wings where we find our protection. Yahweh is like a mother bird, the wings over her brood, and now the chickens have crawled out of the wing and they've gone after another mother hen, Egypt. And Pharaoh's protection will be your shame, the shelter of Egypt's shadow, your confounding. For his ministers have gone to Zoan, and I'm getting into parts, I don't know what it is. But then chapter 30, move over to 15. For thus says Lord Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, your salvation lay in conversion and tranquility. Your salvation lies in conversion, means changing your mind. Your strength in complete trust. And you would have none of it. No, you say, oh, we'll flee on our horses. So be it. Flee! And you add, we'll flee on our swift chariots. So be it, your pursuers will be swift too. It's an arms race. Think you have fast chariots? They'll build faster ones. You're going to put your trust in chariots to get away from the Assyrian army? Or your trust in Egypt and alliances with Egypt? Chapter 31. Woe to those who go down to Egypt to seek help there, who build their hopes on cavalry, who rely on the number of chariots and on the strength of mounted men. Does this ever happen in our world? Trust, feed boxes, places of food, other wings of protection. I added that. Don't look for that in the text. But never look to the Holy One of Israel, nor consult Yahweh. Verse 3, the Egyptian is a man, not a god. His horses are flesh, not spirit. And Yahweh will stretch out his hand to make the protector stumble. The protected will fall, and all will perish together. God, the God of history, is going to ruin Egypt. And if you're under the wings of Mother Hen Egypt, you'll be ruined too. And then verse 5, where is your protection? Like hovering birds, so will Yahweh Sabaoth protect Jerusalem. Sometime read this verse, and when you go on your Holy Land tour, stand in the temple site in Jerusalem and the sunset, watch the birds hovering around. And Isaiah is saying, this is how God is hovering over this city. God is your protection. He will protect it, rescue it, spare it, and save it. Come back to the one you have so wickedly betrayed, O sons of Israel. Now here is a deep belief in the Isaiah school of theology that the Isaiah school of theology will have to change. And the belief is that as long as the Davidic king is in Jerusalem and the temple is in Jerusalem, God will protect Jerusalem from ever being ruined. I will have to look tomorrow about how the Isaiah school has to rethink that. At least for now, this is what they are saying. But what Isaiah is preaching here is trust in the Lord, not in the military power, and not in the alliances with Egypt. Now, in a moment, let's struggle with what does that mean, and what does it even say to us today? Is it just naive religious talk, or what? Now, I want to just mention what happened. When Hezekiah set up the alliance with Egypt to go against Assyria, then this made Assyria and the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, now very, very angry. And the armies of Assyria swept into Judah. You know, I picture Isaiah just weeping. City after city now falls. Sennacherib and his armies now devastate 46 fortified cities in Judah. 46 fortified cities are taken. All of the small towns and cities around them are taken. Over 200,000 people are carried away into captivity by the Assyrian armies. And almost all that is left is Jerusalem. And now the Assyrian armies surround Jerusalem. And Isaiah said, why? Why? If you would have trusted in the Lord instead of Egypt, now look what you have, the wrath of the Assyrian armies, which the prophetic literature calls the wrath of God, that God uses Assyria to bring punishment. And now the armies surround Jerusalem and picture the most, what could be more frightening in the ancient world than to be inside of a city that is sieged. And now they know they are under the siege of an army that has already ruined 46 fortified cities. And now they surround Jerusalem. And what does Isaiah say? I might have lost my place here. I have lost my place. You know, I forgot to say on the tape that this is Dan Erlander. This is the second session on the School of Isaiah. Thank you.
Go, prophet! Go, prophet! Go, prophet!
We know who our cheerleader is. We expect one tomorrow. I'm sure.
Ron refers to the 3 years in the nude, right?
Now, every human being would say it's all over. And here comes old Isaiah again saying, don't worry. About the king of Assyria, chapter 37, verse 33. He will not enter the city. He will not fly. He will let fly no arrow against it. Confronted with no shield, throw up no earthwork against it. By the road that he came on, he'll return. He shall not enter the city. It is Yahweh who speaks. I will protect this city and save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. Now hold that idea, because it's an idea that is held so fervently by Isaiah and also would be by the Isaiah school of theology. What do they do tomorrow when Jerusalem is devastated and the temple is devastated by the next empire, the Empire of Babylon? Now, this is what they still preach. And then a miracle happens. A miracle that, how do you explain this? But by the way, before I say that, if you ever go to London, does anybody have a trip planned to London? Okay, don't miss the, what is the great museum in London?
British
Museum, because during the days of the British Empire, they literally hauled all of Assyria to London. You don't go down there to find ancient Assyria, you go to the British Museum. Amazing reliefs of Sennacherib's invasion of Judah. And relief after relief of one of the greatest fortified cities under Hezekiah was Lachish. And we stood on the ruins of the Tel Lachish when we were on an archaeological trip in Palestine. And you see relief after relief of pictures of Sennacherib's invasion of Judah and the defeat of Lachish. And then there's also a round cylinder scroll that's in the British Museum that is the scroll of Sennacherib. And written right on that scroll is, I had Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. Oh, well. Now, they're all standing on the city walls looking out, the great Assyrian armies surrounding Jerusalem. Hezekiah probably worrying about if they found the water supply yet. Oh, wrong. By this time, Hezekiah has built his underground water system. Ooh, almost made a big mistake. But if you go to Jerusalem, you can even crawl through Hezekiah's tunnel that he built. Is really a great advance in the fortification of Jerusalem to protect its water supply. And when you walk through this tunnel, there is only this much room between the water and the ceiling. You walk through it with your kind of nose up along the ceiling of the tunnel, if you want to. Now, let's get back to these city walls. They look out over the walls, and all of a sudden, the Assyrian armies are rolling up their sleeping bags. Now, again, taking their tents down, rolling up their sleeping bags. And to the astonishment of the people of Jerusalem, Isaiah is the only one who isn't surprised. And Hezekiah, there's Jerusalem, and all of a sudden they see all of the Assyrian armies just packed up and leave. And to imagine they looked each other in. Your first response to great and wonderful news is this can't be true. So you first kind of all look at each other and say, somebody's got to be kidding. Then all of a sudden the reality hits, they just left. And think of the parties that night in Jerusalem. Think of the greatest party you ever went to in your life. Maybe think about V-Day. Was it called V-E? Day? What?
V-J
or V-E or V something. I was too young. But were you out in the streets? What were you doing?
What was I doing? I was in Seattle, and there was just masses and masses of people, everybody hugging and kissing and screaming, and it was marvelous.
Yeah. Okay, this was Jerusalem. It would be called the Assyrians just packed up and left day. The only one who wasn't at the party was Isaiah and his disciples. Now, think of them as the small minority people that are always against the grain. When everybody else is weeping, they're celebrating. When everybody else is celebrating, they're weeping. And their mood would have been this. And there's evidence in different verses. You kind of have to pull these out in different places. That one, 46 cities. 200,000 people into captivity, the whole countryside out there devastated. This isn't a time for celebrating like this. And also Isaiah knew the hearts of the people was not converted. They're the same people that would be going off to other mangers. This was a rather temporary victory. And now, why did the army leave? Is anybody wondering? Why did they just pack up and leave? There's a report in the Old Testament that there's really a plague that ran through the Assyrian army. But also there was a rebellion back in the area of the rivers. And politically it was much more important for Sennacherib and his army to be back there to quell the rebellion nearer to the home in the center of the Assyrian Empire. So the political or the really military decision was made, you know, we cannot take the time or lose the soldiers that we would lose by the final assault on Jerusalem. So it was a matter of military tactics, probably just to turn around and go home and to deal with the rebellion at home. Now imagine how this promoted the idea among all the people that the Isaiah school also held, that God will always protect Jerusalem. Now the idea is, well, Isaiah was right, we never have to worry. God will always protect Jerusalem. Now, what happened to Isaiah after this? It seems like we don't hear from him again. And now he must have gone back with his students, and it's back to class. Back to discerning the will of God, the mind of God, events in history, learning and study. And then when Hezekiah died in 687, came Manasseh, who was one of the worst kings that Judah ever had. He promoted Assyrian gods. The idolatry, and he repressed. He not only tried to discourage Yahwehism. You know what I mean by Yahwehism? The worship of the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Sarah, and the ancestors. He not only discouraged that, but he repressed it, and he persecuted anybody in Judah that worshipped Yahweh. And tradition has it that Isaiah was martyred by King Manasseh. That isn't stated, but that's a tradition. And very, very likely that happened. Now, so Isaiah dies, but his students continue. And now tomorrow we'll see the students of Isaiah coming forth with the message of the school of Isaiah in the great crisis of the rise of the Babylonian Empire. that's the story for today. Now, let's, went longer than I wanted to, but let's, any just reflections or responses or questions, and also to ask the question, what does the message of Isaiah to that time maybe say to our time? Let's invite you to reflect on that.
I think you're tempted. First of all, you were talking about the image of standing on the Temple Mount, seeing the birds. When we did that, we also saw the soldiers with their automatic weapons all around there too, which is a real incongruity there. It's still the same. And then the second image that comes to my mind is what's occurring in Jerusalem today in terms of the rabbinic crowd, the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community that is still uprising, which would be something similar to Isaiah of that time. Still say, you know, pay attention to the word Yahweh. And where is our promise today?
I think the temptation of, you know, religious people today to think that we don't need to take responsibility for what's going on because God will always protect us is really comparable then to that time. It was shown that, I mean, they took that as a sign that we can do whatever we want and God will still protect us in that sense.
Another thing, on the surface, it looked like Isaiah was just saying, oh, don't worry, trust in the Lord. But when you really get under that, Isaiah was astute in his understanding of the kind of political and military situation of that time. But trusting in God was also doing the thing that would bring the greatest long-term deep security to the people. Which comes, I think, as a thundering question to us in our age, our day.
I had a question on chapter 7, verse 14, in the way you explained the child. Explain to me how, if this woman is to bear and call her son Emmanuel, which is translated God with us, how could there be God coming in that age? I mean, is that not a scripture of the foretelling of the Christ?
Oh, okay. Now, good question. The Isaiah pointed to a sign in that time, and by saying God with us, you know, he wasn't thinking the same as later John. You know, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and Christ, you know, Jesus being the Son of God. But rather, this child is a sign that what Isaiah always said in his preaching, God with us, this child is a sign of the Word Emmanuel, that God is with us. Now, Isaiah got carried away with his signs, and I mean carried away in the best sense. You know, he talked about a king that will soon be born and called that king Wonderful Counselor, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And he would throw so much dignity on that person that it was impossible that one human being could ever fulfill that. But it was Isaiah dreaming. And then later Christians realized those dreams of Isaiah that he would put on people that he thought were going to be born very soon could only be fulfilled in the risen and ascended Christ. So he was kind of
I still disagree though, because the word there, woman, comes from a Hebrew name Ha Alma, which is only virgin. And if a virgin could conceive, I mean, it could only refer to Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's your reflection. I think I would be correct in saying that most scholars would disagree, but the correct translation is young woman of marriageable age.
Then they would disagree with the King James Version as well. Mm-hmm. The King James says a virgin shall conceive.
Right. Now, and that was, if you remember the furor when the RSV came out in the 40s, there were public burnings of the RSV because the RSV chose to translate this young woman, which I think most contemporary translations now have young woman, because the use of the word virgin there was really reading our, or as I see it, or as I perceive it, was reading our Christian doctrine back into the Old Testament.
Yeah, in line with that same discussion in chapter 8, there's reference to the birth of another child.
Oh, yeah, I forgot him.
Meher
Shelah Hashbaz.
Something like that. What is the relationship? Is that the same child or
no,
another different?
No, this I can't say it. Meher Shelah Hashbaz was Isaiah's second child, it seems to be, by his wife, who was a prophetess.
Yes, the same issue seems to be at stake.
And then, so Isaiah uses the birth now of his child as another sign to Hezekiah, and it's by the name he gives to this child. Now, I forgot which context. I'm back with Ahaz, right? In chapter 8?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm back with Ahaz. Right, I'm mixed up here. And the name Meher Shelah Hashbaz is quick the spoils, speedy the plunder. So then, you know, he'll go to the king, and now with his son, I'd like you to meet my son. Quick the spoils, speedy the plunder. And naming is very significant, because the king has to keep looking at this child, and you kind of get the point. You know, here comes little quick the spoils, speedy the plunder.